Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Molly Struve, Site Reliability Engineer at Forum. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Do you want to tell us about yourself?
Yeah, so I am a Site Reliability Engineer at a company called Forum. And basically, my job is to ensure that all of our systems remain up and reliable for all of our clients and users to use.
And there's been a recent name change, branding change type thing from dev.2 to Forum. Is that right?
Yeah. So we've kind of gone through this, you know, this change where when I initially joined, which was just over a year ago now, we were, you know, our sole focus was on dev.2 and running that community and making that open source. And since then, over the past year, we have branched out, and so we're no longer just focusing on dev, but we have chosen to bring the platform that dev is built on and the values that, you know, dev has and bring it to the masses, shall we say, and basically offer a version of the dev community, what we call Forum, which we got from kind of shortening for empowering community. And now, you know, our goal is to bring that to many different kinds of communities, whether you might be, you know, interested in fashion, whether you might be interested in horses or rock climbing. The goal now is to kind of allow other people and empower other people to spin up those communities and give them the tools they need so that they can have their own communities that thrive.
And how does that work? Is that like a product that you can sign up for and pay a monthly subscription, or does it work some other way? How does that work?
So we're still kind of, you know, working out all of those kinks of exactly like how does that pay structure work. But right now, obviously, we're open source. So you can always, it's free to anyone who would like to kind of download the repo, and you can kind of go on Heroku and just pay for hosting it yourself. Or we've got it now so that you can email us and we can literally set it up and run it for you. And so we're doing all of that on AWS. And literally we've got a systems team now. We just brought on a systems team, and their sole job is literally just spinning up these new forums, these new communities every single day. And we've got about, you know, just over probably 15 new communities started now. And it's pretty exciting to see the technology and strategy that's worked so well for dev kind of get shared and see all these other people getting the chance to kind of enjoy it as well.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Can you give us a sample of like what are some of these communities? Like, are some of them tech oriented, or is it like all over the map and different kinds of stuff?
So a lot of them are tech oriented. We've got is another one that got spun up. But then we also have communities that are no way related to tech. We've got which is started by a guy that we've been working with over in Europe. We've got other communities, a fashion blog. We've got, you know, different kind of communities like that. So it's all over the board. And we have clients that are interested in spinning up internal communities. So like for their companies. So say you've got a group of employees, for example, at Microsoft. They're not one of the ones that we're working with right now, but just as an example. And maybe you want an internal community for your team so you can kind of blog about internal stuff. We're exploring those options as well. And a lot of companies are interested in that as an option. So you kind of have that kind of internal community that you can kind of lock down and control, but also kind of gives your employees the freedom to write blog posts, interact with each other in kind of a safe environment.
Nice. So I'm excited to talk with you about the technical stuff that we're going to talk about. Every time I talk with a site reliability engineer type person, or we talk about like server related stuff on the show, it seems to be really popular. So people are really into this topic, it seems. So I'm pumped to talk about it. And it's something that I personally am interested in. Just a quick tidbit of a background of my SRE related experience. I've never been an SRE by title or anything like that, but at the job that I worked at before this, I was on call a lot for not so much for incidents always, although like infrastructure incidents were certainly part of it, but it was more like super urgent customer support requests that would get escalated. It would start at a support person and then get escalated like to a second tier support person and then ultimately get escalated to an engineer. And so just like all day, every day, my phone was ringing off the hook with the pager duty alerts, and I would respond to those. And I think it was kind of unusual because like I would get paged up to like 8 or 10 times a day, which I think is unusual. You probably get paged less frequently than that because you're working on different kinds of stuff. Okay, so that's where I'm coming from. And my first question for you is, what is your interaction with the organization like? Do you work as an SRE on a team of SREs, or do you work on a team of developers, or is it not even team-oriented at all? How does that part work?
That's a great question. So when I joined, I was just the sole SRE with a bunch of developers, and I still am a little bit. We're a very fluid team, and so like right now, it's me, and then I have two developers that are kind of focused on SRE tasks. So I've kind of got my project board of SRE tasks that I want done. So I've kind of been given two developers who are now focusing on those more SRE related tasks. We are definitely looking into the future. We're looking to kind of build a more solid SRE team, because I think in order to really kind of ingrain that SRE mindset, that ability to, you know, think big picture and to look at code from, you know, a different angle than say like a feature developer. When you look at code as an SRE, you look at it and you think, okay, how does this interact with our physical systems? How does this interact with our database? What happens if I hit this endpoint a million times? Those are kind of like that SRE mindset. The best way to gain it is to basically just kind of do it over and over again. And so with that in mind, we're looking towards moving to a more steady and kind of permanent SRE team in the future, which I'm pretty excited about. But in terms of my day-to-day, it's, you know, it's really kind of doing some SRE work myself and then just kind of crafting these projects that I know will help move us forward and make the site more reliable and more observable, and just kind of not only make my life easier, but make also the developers' lives easier.
Okay. So are you currently the sole SRE at Forum? Is the entire SRE weight resting on your shoulders?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I'm the only one with the SRE title. I'm hoping to kind of, you know, maybe we'll give that title to a couple more people if they decide that SRE is like where they want to kind of plant their flag. I've got one right now who's very enthusiastic and really enjoys it, so I'm kind of hoping I can bring him to the dark side. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I said, I'm kind of the sole person right now that's got the big picture mindset. And so kind of then part of my job, because I'm the only one who's, you know, officially the SRE, a lot of my job also becomes just educating the developers on how to kind of think a little bit like an SRE so that they can kind of help me ensure that the code remains performant and reliable. Because when there's only one of me and there's, oh Lord, you have like 15 developers, you've got to kind of get that SRE message across to everybody, so that otherwise I'm just trying to hop around and just make sure, you know, everything they push is reliable and performant. But the more I can educate everyone around me, it becomes much more of a team effort. And so that's kind of the interesting part that comes in with kind of being the first SRE at a job, is you not only have to worry about the application itself, but you really need to kind of help educate those around you so that they can help you out in your job until you're able to kind of grow that team.
Interesting. Maybe we can talk about performance for a second, because in my perception, a lot of developers, especially earlier in their career, they like overemphasize performance and they think about it too early and prematurely optimize and stuff like that. But in a case like yours with Dev2 and Forum, it's no longer a premature optimization because you guys actually have traffic. And so the performance makes a big difference. So I wanted to say that partially because, like, if we're talking about performance without putting that into the context of a high traffic site, that might reinforce somebody's wrong proportion of performance and think like, oh yeah, performance, there it is again. I need to make everything super performant, which if you're writing an application for like an internal, like the application that I work on, it's internal facing and we have like 40 some employees or something like that. Performance is not a paramount concern, but for you, it is more relevant. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, is there maybe an example of some code that got pushed or something that caused a performance problem or something like that?
So performance is definitely something that's always on my mind. But I also kind of like to stress to people, and I think you said it, you know, pretty well, don't get so wrapped up in like, oh my Lord, is this going to be the fastest, you know, way possible? Because sometimes, like you said, you could end up over-optimizing. You know, for example, maybe you want to use a find each, but you're thinking, oh my God, what happens if we have a million users? Maybe we should write this crazy raw SQL query. Nah, like maybe not. Like kind of, you know, you don't want to get ahead of yourself. So you want to think, you know, into the future, think performance, but also I always encourage people not to get too far ahead. But like one example is our homepage. We've got the, you know, the feed of articles, the feed of posts that show up when you hit the homepage, and that we gather through an algorithm. And at one point, someone updated the feed algorithm, and it slowed down a little bit. Not, you know, it wasn't horrible, but I kind of went in and I looked at it in some of our monitoring tools. One of which I can't say enough good things about, is Honeycomb. And I opened up a trace and I saw we were hitting the database, grabbing this, you know, these tags, the same tags like 50 times. And so I was like, why are we making the same database call 50 times? Like, this seems like something we don't need to do. And it ended up being that we had, you know, stuck a simple tag lookup inside a block as opposed to pulling it outside the block, where we could just look up the tags, store them in a simple local, you know, array variable, and then use that in the block. So it's a lot of times it's little things like that, just kind of where you might be making a database query over and over again that you don't anticipate. And that's one of the, you know, areas where monitoring and kind of observability and being able to look at those traces and look at all those logs comes into handy. It's funny, a lot of people, you know, they always ask me, how do you find these things? How do you track them down? And it's honestly, I read a lot of logs. I'm not going to lie. When I, you know, find a slow endpoint or something that just looks like, you know, why is this, you know, maybe this could be faster, or this is taking 300 milliseconds. I feel like it should be taking 10. If you open up those logs, you'd be amazed at what you find. And it's so easy to find those repetitive database queries where you're making the same query, you know, 10, 15, 20 times, and you could make it once. Maybe you're hitting Redis. I think one of the things one of the first talks I ever gave was on local caching. And I think we've got things like Redis that are incredibly fast. And so people just lean into them hard, which is great. You know, Redis is fantastic. But if you are, you know, making a call to Redis 1,000 times, when to get the same variable, when theoretically you could store it locally and then just access that local variable, it's going to be a lot faster than having to talk to an external service 1,000 times. So it's, you know, it's kind of, you got these different levels of performance of, you know, of improving stuff and kind of being able to keep that all in your mind and is kind of part of what the art of being an SRE is, and figuring out which level you need to go to get the performance you need.
So something you said was interesting to me, because when I like find out about issues I need to address, sometimes it's like this, specifically with performance issues. So I will like go visit some of our offices and talk with the users of the system, and they'll be like, hey, this one page, this is starting to get like pretty slow. It's starting to be like a problem because it's so slow. And I'll like make a note of that, and then I'll go fix that performance issue. But I only find out about it that way because I have the ability to talk directly to the users, and I have like a reason to go talk to them and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're operating a more public-facing site, maybe you don't get feedback in exactly that form. And so you have to find out about things just from looking at the log and stuff like that. Is that the right idea?
So we actually have monitors set up. So we have monitors that basically say, okay, we expect a response time of, you know, under 500 milliseconds for this page. And we track that. We keep track of that time. And if that time goes, say, above 500 milliseconds, we get alerted to it. And so we use a combination.
Is that like a honeycomb thing or something else?
We use a combination of Honeycomb and Datadog to get it done. Both of them have, you know, the ability to track this stuff. But we've got maybe 50 monitors set up that literally their sole job is to monitor, you know, response times for certain queries, response times for Elasticsearch queries, response time for database queries. And if any of those go above a certain threshold, that means either there's, you know, we need to be looking at the code. Sometimes it means we might need to beef up our database because, you know, we're running out of RAM. We're kind of exceeding our limits there. So when you're working at a larger scale, especially now that we have, you know, multiple forums all over, you have to have a central monitoring system in place in order to help you manage it all. Otherwise, it's going to be nearly impossible for someone to kind of go and anticipate where these slowdowns are going to happen.
Okay. And you already have like a huge responsibility in that you have to keep all of the 15 apps or whatever up and running, which I do not envy that task. But in addition to that, are you also responsible for all the infrastructure and stuff like that, or just keeping it running? Or tell me about that part.
Yeah. So luckily, like I said, we, you know, recently just, we brought in a systems engineer probably about 6 months ago. And then we just added two more in the past month. So now we've got a three-person systems team. And so their main focus is the infrastructure. So if I need a bigger database somewhere, I just tap one of them on the shoulder and I said, hi, you know, hey, I need an RDS boost here. Can we upgrade that? And they're the ones that do that. So that's kind of a big, you know, piece off my plate. Prior to that, we were just on Heroku. And so, you know, Heroku makes managing those kind of things easy. So luckily we've got that infrastructure team now, which, you know, takes a lot of it off my plate, but I'm still responsible for how the code interacts with that infrastructure and, you know, making sure we're not abusing databases, trying to pull like all the records out at once to make sure we're not tipping over servers because we're, you know, running them out of memory. So those things definitely still follow me, and it's really a team effort between, you know, systems and SRE, and then, you know, I kind of bridge that gap between then the developers to make the whole thing run smoothly. And kind of like with, you know, your comment to say that, you know, we have all these forums now, all these applications, and keeping those up and running. Another thing that I kind of have to think about in terms of, you know, it's not just performance now, but it's also, what's the word I'm looking for? The ability to replicate these forms over and over again. How do we write code that is going to be reliable when it's, you know, spun up and, you know, creates new apps over and over again? So reproducibility. I now have to think about reproducibility every time we write code. Like what, for example, one of the things that kind of came out of that is, what happens when we change code and say we need to pre-populate a column with some data? Normally, if you have one application, you could just bring up a console. Someone can go in and run a little script and boom, you get your updated data. You know, things are backfilled or whatever. But when you have 15 forms, going into 15 consoles is just not scalable. So now we've got an infrastructure in place that we call data update scripts. And so they're very similar to kind of like running a database migration where you update your schema, and that in our code, we put the scripts now in the code, and that code ensures that when the app gets deployed, all of the apps get those scripts and they run automatically. So it's putting in place systems like that that make that reproducibility a lot easier. So that's kind of something else that has been on my plate recently, kind of in addition to the normal performance stuff. And it's a really interesting challenge, and it's something I faced at my previous job on a smaller scale, but it's kind of a lot of fun to tackle.
Yeah, that adds like a whole dimension of complexity to everything. How did you tackle this? Like, I could imagine at least a couple of different ways that this could possibly be done. Is like, one is if you have 15 apps, you could conceivably have 15 different code bases, 15 completely separate, isolated infrastructures, or you could have one single app with like multi-tenancy and it's all on mm-hmm. just one infrastructure, or you could have something completely different. How did you guys tackle all that stuff?
So right now we've got 15 separate apps, and mainly because that was kind of the quickest way to get spun up. Is the app is totally self-sufficient, so we could very quickly on AWS, you know, through our Terraform infrastructure, just pop these puppies up. So right now they're all separate. But down the road, the goal is to do some multi-tenancy solutions where they have, say, shared databases, shared Elasticsearch clusters, shared Redises, to, you know, just to kind of cut down on the consistent duplication of having 15 databases. If we could have one database and then partition everyone off into their own schemas, that's way, you know, way easier from an infrastructure and an SRE perspective in terms of being able to kind of handle and run. So those kind of solutions are definitely on our radar. Right now, we're kind of still in that like MVP phase of our infrastructure. And so we're kind of taking the path of least resistance right now, but it's definitely something that we're thinking about going into the future.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Any way you slice it, that's not an easy thing to do. And like, there's no like probably one best way to do it. That's all upsides and no downsides. It's just a trade-off of which sets of pros and cons do you want? So another thing I want to ask you about is just like the kinds of incidents you find yourself responding to. And like, obviously the answer is probably going to be that like, there's no common pattern, because the idea hopefully is that you have an incident, you address the root cause, so you never have that kind of incident again. But what kind of stuff is this? We've mentioned like performance, memory, stuff like that. Can you tell me what kind of stuff you respond to?
Yeah. So usually, and kind of the goal in having a good monitoring system in place is that when you're responding to stuff, you're catching it early. So it's not necessarily a fire drill. So for example, we have a Elasticsearch query slowdown monitor. And so when that goes off, then I have to go in and be like, okay, why are we slowing down? Do we have a spike in traffic? Do we have an issue with the indexes? And really the goal is that it's not, like I said, it's not a fire drill. It's okay that we have a minor slowdown. And I think that is most of what I respond to. We've got a slowdown. Another common alert is we have someone, you know, pen testing our site irresponsibly. And so they're throwing, you know, they're hitting us 10 million times in the course of like 45 minutes. And we're throwing all these 429s. And luckily we've got throttling in place so that when someone does that, it doesn't affect other users, but it still pings alarms because we don't really want to have somebody doing that. And so we can go in and block IPs if they become problematic, et cetera.
Wait, so, sorry, can we unpack that one a little bit? First of all, what's a 429?
Oh, a 429, that's my bad, is a too many response error code. When you get a 429, that means you have hit the limit of how many times that server wants you to hit it. And so if you start pinging dev, you know, certain endpoints, for example, we don't expect anyone to create 1,000 articles in 5 minutes. So we have a limit on how many articles you can create, you know, in a given amount of time. We don't expect someone to create, you know, messages, more than 2 messages in a second. And so we've got limits on that. So we have all these limits that are set up through the application so that when someone does that, when someone tries to kind of basically kind of DOS us, instead of having it go all the way through the app and have the database get bogged down, have our background jobs get bogged down, we hit these limits and we immediately say, sorry, 429, you've exceeded the number of requests we allow, and we just spit that back at them. And that prevents our servers, all of our infrastructure from getting overloaded while, you know, still being able to kind of run the site. And so that's something we actually, I would say we see a lot, but every, you know, couple of weeks, you'll see one kind of pop up. My theory is, you know, usually if it pops up once, I'll let it go. I'll kind of take the high road and assume it was a pen tester that might just not have been following the rules. If we see it twice, you can bet that IP is blocked.
Okay.
So.
And can you tell me more about the pen tester thing? So obviously pen tester, that's short for penetration testing. Somebody, yes. Is there somebody trying to get like a hacker bounty type thing or something like that? Or how does that all work?
Yeah, so we actually have a pen tester program, and a lot of companies have these programs where you literally say, okay, if you find a vulnerability in our site, and one of the vulnerabilities is, you know, this DOS vulnerability, if you can take down a site by hitting it so many times. And so pen testers, what they do is they come in and they'll do stuff like that, such as hit an endpoint. And if for some reason they don't get a 429 after hitting it an excessive amount of times, they might say, okay, I found this vulnerability for your website. You don't have a rate limit on this endpoint. And so then they would email us and be like, this endpoint is not rate limited. And, you know, we perceive that as a vulnerability. There's a whole classification system to like rate, you know, how severe a vulnerability is. And based on that system, we will then pay out a bounty. So we will literally say, okay, this was, you know, this is a mild, you know, vulnerability. We're not expecting to be that bad. So, you know, we'll pay out $50 for this. We've had larger vulnerabilities that have, you know, been found that you might pay out like $100, $200, $300 for, depending on kind of the severity. And so that's where you get these kind of pen testers coming in. And it's because of pen testing that we've got that throttling in place now. We had pen testers tell us, like, these endpoints aren't protected. You need throttling on them. And so we put the throttling in place. And so when, you know, we had this one person come through and hit us 10 million times over the course of 45 minutes, it didn't take us down. It didn't slow us down. We got alarms about the 429s, but that was it. And when that happened, that was a big day for me, because that to me said, okay, we just spent in, you know, months putting all of this throttling in place. And like, there's my proof, like that paid off. That was all worth it, because this person was not able to disrupt our other users by hitting us, you know, excessively. And so that's kind of the value of pen testing, is being able to have people kind of, basically they attempt to break your site in a nice way. So, you know, pen testers, these kind of bounty programs, they've got a lot of rules around them to ensure that they don't affect actual users, but they definitely can pay off when it comes to making sure your site is protected. So it's definitely something, you know, I highly recommend for any website, is to do some sort of bounty program, because it does pay off. And we've kind of shown that it's paid off immensely for us.
And can you tell me how mechanically this throttling works? Because like, okay, they hit your site once and the request actually works and all this stuff happens that would normally happen when somebody like saves an article or whatever, then maybe the second time too, but then when they hit that throttle, like, what happens to stop everything else from happening that would affect your site negatively?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different layers, but I'll kind of just go to the simplest layer is, so our app is a rack application. And so when someone hits it, one of the first things that happens once the server gets the request is we have a series of checks that we run in Redis. And we basically say, give me this IP. Okay, how many times has this IP hit us? And we store this stuff in Redis, so it's very fast. And if that IP has already hit us, and I think we've just got a general, you know, thing, we've got a, just kind of a general level of throttling. If this IP has hit us more times than we allow, then we return a 429. So that's kind of one of the simple layers. Now, if it goes through there, and goes down to our, you know, keeps going through to say like our controller or whatever, our database, then we've got another level where it's like, okay, maybe how many posts has this user created? And that's a database query at that point. So we've kind of got our first level, which is Redis. And so that's, if someone just really just goes ham on us, like it's just going to, we're just going to be hitting Redis over and over again. And Redis is going to be like, nope, 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 nope. If it goes through and it gets the database, then maybe the database says, okay, this user has created 10 posts already in the last minute. That's our limit. And it'll literally just say, you know, return a 429. It literally just raises the error. So it just stops processing in its tracks and shoves the error back at the user. So it's just kind of a quick, it's basically just, you know, ripcord basically of the request.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, no, I'm starting to get concerned because my site doesn't have anything like that. And so theoretically, there's nothing stopping somebody from DDoSing us. Luckily, we're not a very like prominent target. I don't think anybody listening to this even knows the name of the company, which is actually not true. I just put up a job ad, which was the first time I publicly shared the name of the place where I work. So if you're listening to this and you're a hacker, please don't DDoS us. Anyway, Molly, how has your job changed over time? Like, first of all, when you started at what was then Dev2, did they use Heroku at that time, or was that after they migrated to AWS? And then just like, how has everything grown since then?
Yeah, so when I started, you know, one of the things I was brought in for is, so we had Dev2 and it was run on Heroku, because I mean, Heroku is the go-to solution. If you want to get up and running quickly, you got a Heroku. And it's great. It is great for that. But one of the other things, you know, that I was brought in for is we used a lot of paid services. So we used Algolia for search. We used Memcache. And there's another one that was, yeah. So those were the kind of the two big ones. Algolia was the big one. That was a paid search service. And, you know, the foundation of Dev is being open source and using open source technologies. And so one of the first things I did was I came in, I moved us off Memcache to Redis, which is, you know, just, it's way less of a black box. You know, you can do a lot of different things with Redis that you can't do with Memcache. And then I moved us off Algolia to Elasticsearch. Once again, an open source search solution. And so those were kind of the big things that, you know, I did coming in. It was kind of helping us get off these paid services onto open source stuff. We also, when I first came in, I think I said, okay, what do we use for monitoring? And I think I had 8 or 9 different things thrown at me. It's like, how are we supposed to keep track? Like, I can't be expected to open 9 websites when I want to know how the app's running. So then I consolidate our monitoring system. So now we have 2. You know, like I said, Datadog and Honeycomb.
Okay. Basically. Yeah, and sorry, you're kind of answering this question already a little bit, but like, how did the people at Dev2 before you got hired, how did they know that they needed an SRE person to help with that kind of stuff?
So, you know, I think it was Ben who really championed the effort, and he kind of knew where he wanted the company to go. He knew he wanted these open source solutions brought in. And he kind of knew that this might be something we could share with everybody. And so he brought me in early on, which is something that I think is huge and something that I've talked about in other podcasts. I don't know, maybe he listened to the other podcast.
And Ben Halpern, the Ben creator Halpern, of, yeah.
The founder of Dev2 and now Forum. I think bringing in an SRE super early, because a lot of people, you know, SRE was coined by Google, which is massive. And so I think because of kind of how it came about, a lot of people just assume unless you're a big company or you have millions of users, like you don't need an SRE. But I think the earlier you have an SRE mindset, the earlier you think about scalability, reproducibility, performance, the better off you're going to be. And that's why, like I said, that's why now when I respond to incidences, it's not fire drills. It's, okay, we're slightly slowing down here. How do we fix this before it becomes a big issue? And I think that's huge. That makes, you know, scaling a lot less chaotic because I came in really early and I was able, you know, I was able to find all those places in the code base that were not going to scale. And so now that we're scaling, everything's gone a bit smoother. Do you still have those hiccups? Yes. Do you still have those endpoints that suddenly become popular and all of a sudden you're like, oh crap, like this endpoint's taking 5 seconds to respond. Like, what did we do wrong? You definitely, you're always going to kind of have those, but by bringing an SRE on early, you can really minimize those kind of fire drills that you have. And it just makes life a whole lot better for everybody.
That makes a lot of sense. I have the SRE, the Google SRE book on my bookshelf. And one of the things it says is something like, here's how we look at it. We want to think about site infrastructure from the perspective of a software developer. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And it represented maybe a little bit of a mental shift for me. And what I'm thinking is like, okay, Molly, since Dev.2 hired you relatively early, it's going to be so much easier as they go to like keep all their infrastructure like tidy and have good solid practices going forward. Because like, okay, here's a quick example from my work. We had an incident a while ago where the site went down. Nobody knew why. I discovered why was one of the server's hard disks just filled up. And so, yeah. And so I needed to kill that server and I created a new one and it was ultimately fine. But then I added, of course, some disk space monitoring so that I get an alert when the disk is like 80% full instead of only finding out when it's completely full. And that's like maybe an example of a... Okay, so imagine if I didn't know anything about anything, which I'm pretty close to not knowing anything about anything, but...
Oh, we all.
Right. Not quite. And so I knew enough to do that little thing, but imagine if I didn't. And I said, okay, I'm just going to delete this. And then like next time it happens, I'll just deal with it at that point. Or I'll like try to remember to like log in once a month and like check on it or something like that, which seems terrible. But instead, I implemented what you could call an SRE practice. And so now we're going to be like so much better off. And so that's probably what's going to happen at Dev.2. It already has been happening. Whereas if they had waited until like 5 years from now to hire somebody like you, it would be so much harder to get to that good place with their infrastructure stuff.
Exactly. And what you're describing that, you know, that, oh, I'm just going to restart the server and whatever this, you know, and then you walk away and you say, you know, I just got to remember to check that in a couple months. Anytime you say to yourself, I got to remember to do that, or it's fine, I'll just check it later. That is when that's like a red flag. That's like, okay, we need to be automating this. This is not something we can rely on human intervention. Because once you rely on human intervention, it just all goes to crap after that. Like it's you just can't do it. That's why all these systems have to be automated in place. And that's, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think that is what creates some of these really kind of toxic on-call systems, is when it's just people responding to stuff and you're not getting ahead of the problem. And then you're burning out your engineers. You know, it's not even their job really to think about this stuff, but all of a sudden now, oh my God, my database went down. You know, okay, that's fine. We'll make the database bigger. Cool. We're good. But then no one's like, well, what happens when we get slow? And like, are we just going to wait till the database goes down again? Like, how do we proactively kind of get ahead of this? And so if no one's thinking about that, then that's when you get that horrible on-call, you know, culture where it's just like everything's a fire drill and you're just, it's constantly, you know, you're constantly stressed and burning out engineers.
Yeah. So it's kind of like that thing, like that Eisenhower planning grid or whatever, where there's the four quadrants. It's like urgent and important, urgent, but not important, important, but not urgent. And then neither urgent nor important.
Yeah.
And if you don't spend any of your time on that quadrant two, the important but not urgent, then you'll like always be dealing with the urgent and important issues. So how do you divide your time between responding to incidents, so those quadrant one things, versus those quadrant two activities of like prevention and stuff like that?
So early on, you know, and even now, because I was brought in so early, I was able to put in a lot of these practices to ensure you never get to, you know, important and urgent at the same time. And because of that, I'm going to be honest. I don't spend a ton of, I'm going to knock on wood right now because it's Thanksgiving week here. I'm sure the alarms are going to start sounding, but I don't spend a lot of time reacting. Because I was brought in so early and I was able to set up these systems, most of my job is planning and thinking where we're going to be in 6 months and continuing to architect our system so that when it's ready, when we get there. And that's kind of how you know you've done it right, is if you're spending more time planning and not as much time responding to incidences. And so that's, you know, and that's like, I'm trying to think of, you know, we had a small minor incident. We had an Elasticsearch slowdown, which turned out to be, you know, with the index related a week ago. And then before that, I couldn't even tell you when the last time I was actually kind of responded or tweaked something, but it doesn't happen often. I'd say, you know, we get incidents maybe once every couple of weeks in terms of just like traffic. And then the other thing is, you know, if we break something, which we all do, we all deploy a little config change and boop, there goes the site. Honestly, I probably respond to those like, oh crap, we just pushed out a bug. Like, how do we roll this back? More so than like an actual structural infrastructure problem.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that's nice. That, like, if I think back to when the last time I responded to like a real genuine incident, I remember that it was before coronavirus, so it must have been 2019, and there was not yet snow on the ground. So it was sometime before October.
Yep.
So that was a pretty long time ago, more than a year ago. So that's pretty nice. Compared to the last place I worked, where I think we were talking pre-show, it was like all day, every day. When I was on my on-call rotation, I was responding to not infrastructure incidents, but like support request stuff. So that was a different kind of a thing. But it sure is nice not to get paged.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, especially like once you've experienced getting paged for a while and then you like don't get paged anymore, you really appreciate that feeling of just not getting paged. Have you ever been like, I don't know, one time I was like out on a date with my wife and I got paged. And so I just had to go respond to an incident.
Yeah.
Sorry, wife, I have to leave our date right now. Have you ever had like your personal life really interrupted by something?
I have had it interrupted before. So one specific thing that comes to mind, and actually, you know, I've usually had it. It's usually kind of been pretty mild where like if I was really in the middle of something, I was able to talk someone through how to fix it. But the one I remember pretty distinctly is I was at a wedding and we like pull up to the wedding and I'm on call and like the alarms start going off. I'm like, oh, crap. So everyone goes in, you know, it's probably like a half an hour, 45 minutes to the wedding. And I'm on my computer. And then all of a sudden, you know, we figure out what's wrong. And it's like, there's a bad script running and like, we got to fix it. We got to stop the script. We got to unlock the database. And then we've got to backfill it with old data. We've got to go back into one of our backups. And I remember I was working. At one point, you know, luckily a couple other engineers were helping me. I said, okay, I have to go in. I ran into like the church, watched the wedding for 15 minutes. They got married. I ran back out and during cocktail hour, finished wrapping up the incident. We got, you know, we got the database reset to where we needed it to be. And I think in total it was like an hour and a half. And so by the time I had closed my laptop, you know, everyone was sitting down to dinner and I just walked in and I was like, someone hooked me up with a drink. And I remember that. And it's this one couple's wedding. And every time, you know, their anniversary comes up, I'm like, I remember what I was doing on that day.
That's funny.
That was probably the worst one. Otherwise, for the most part, it's, you know, it's not horrible. Sometimes you get those late night stuffs that keep you up late. I think that's the most common one is sometimes an incident goes late or you have to run maintenance late. Those ones always get me. So I am a self-confessed, I go to bed at like I kind of climb into bed at like 9:30 and I read. I'm like to bed by 10. Okay. I know I am a total like, you know, oddball when it comes to developers. Most people are like night owls, but I like to wake up early. I get all my best work done I get up at like 6:30, I go for my run, boom, and then I start working, and it's great. So honestly, the biggest disruption is whenever we have to do like the late night maintenance. I'm always kind of like, I always have to roll my eyes. Oh God, it's going to be a long night.
That's always terrible.
Yeah, at my old team, I actually got them to do early morning maintenance a couple of times, but most people weren't fans of that. So I was like, fine, I'll just do the late maintenance with everybody.
Yeah, I like to get up early too. Like, I had kind of let myself slip for a while, and I was getting up at maybe like 7:30 or so. And then recently, I worked my way up to like, I think it was 6:30 that I was getting up fairly consistently. And it's great because I get so much more work done in the early hours. Oh, yeah. Than, you know, like 2 hours from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. is like worth so much more than 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. or whatever. And so that's great. But then I recently took a trip out west. And so the transition from Eastern time to Pacific time and then back completely destroyed my sleep schedule.
Oh, I want to do that. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so Molly, last question for you before the final question of where do people find you online and stuff like that. I told you I was going to ask you about horses, so now I'm going to ask you about horses. Tell us about your equine hobby.
Yeah, so I've been riding since I was 5 years old, so over 25 years now, and I'm getting old. And I do a discipline called show jumping. So basically I take a horse in a ring and there's a set course of obstacles that I have to jump the horse over. And the primary goal is to jump those, what we call jumps. So the obstacles are called jumps, as fast as possible without knocking any of the obstacles down. And that's what I do. And it's something I've been doing for a long time. And it's almost, you know, in a lot of ways, it's almost like a second job. I am an amateur, in a sense that I don't get paid for it, but I have, you know, anywhere from, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 horses that I ride on a consistent basis. And so it takes up a lot of my time. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really fortunate about this career and being a software developer is that you can do it from anywhere. So basically whenever we travel to horse shows, as long as I have an internet connection, I can still do my job, which is great. I can take my laptop.
Are you ever on call and on a horse at the same time?
Yes, I have been. I have never. So there are times when, so, you know, like my mom or like my husband will come to a horse show with me and I'll give him my phone. And my thing is, if it beeps more than twice, that's when you have to grab me. And so, and everyone knew that if it was a total drag out emergency that only Molly could solve, like you have to ping her twice on Slack or twice on pager duty if you wanted her instant response. And most people knew when I was riding, I used the Slack emoji, the little horse head. And so everyone knows when I'm on a horse. So for the most part, like I've never been grabbed off a horse to solve an issue.
That's good. That'd be terrible. Yeah. What was I going to say? Yeah. So fun fact, when I was a kid, I got kicked in the head by a horse, and that's why I'm so stupid. Just kidding. That didn't actually happen. But what is true is my mom had horses when we were growing up, and so I used to ride horses sometimes, and I got knocked off a horse one time. There was like a low branch on a tree on our property, and I was on the horse, and it's a fuzzy memory by now, but like the horse just ran me into the branch, and I got knocked off the horse. I'm sure you've had your fair share of horse injuries.
Ironically, that's something we have in common. I have also been knocked off a horse by a branch before, and it was definitely very interesting. But no, it was kind of a running joke at my old company that when we were smaller, our CEO would come to visit, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm going to Nationals next week, and he'd be like, did you commit all your code? Please commit your code before you go. And so it was kind of the running joke before Molly got on a horse. Like, did she commit all of her code? So luckily, you know, I've had my fair share of injuries. I've broken a wrist and a thumb. The wrist was a little brutal. I was hunting and pecking for a couple of weeks, but then I got a small cast on, so I was still able to do my job. But let me tell you, anyone who has kind of the wrist issues and the finger issues and uses that, you know, the voice recognition to like type in code, my hat's off to you, because that is that's some crazy stuff. So knock on wood again, like luckily I've been fortunate, but yeah, there's always that kind of running joke, like, Molly, commit your code before you get on a horse.
That's funny. Yeah, I don't think I've gotten an injury that has affected my programming abilities. I feel like maybe I've like hurt my hand a little bit that like made it a little slower for me to type.
Yeah.
And then I got a concussion when I was skiing, and that like messed me up for, I wasn't really able to fully work for at least a couple days or something like that. By the way, was that, so you and I have met at a couple conferences. I think one was RailsConf in Minneapolis, if I remember correctly. Yep. And then also Ruby Hack in Salt Lake City. Is that right?
Yeah, that was the first one, I'm pretty sure, was Ruby Hack.
Yeah, it was just like the day after Ruby Hack, I went skiing and hit my head.
Oh, that, no kidding. Yeah. Oh, that's brutal.
Yeah.
That was recently. That was the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Back when, you know, we could see each other.
Right. Yeah, so maybe we'll see each other again at RubyConf 2023 or something like that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, well, until then, and we can see people in person at conferences again, where can people go to find you online?
Yeah, so Molly_Struvey on Twitter. My DMs are open. Molly@dev.to is my email address. As I always say, I love chatting with people about this stuff. Always open. Please feel free to email me, drop me a DM, whatever. Always happy to talk about SRE and anything related to tech or horses. If you want to know about horses, we can chat about that too.
Awesome. Well, Molly, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.